Welcome to the Rising Laterally podcast.
Each episode, you will learn something fascinating so you can bring big ideas to your small talk.
Your growth is our growth. Listening to these episodes, subscribing to our weekly newsletter, engaging our posts on social media, and sharing our show with your friends and family is deeply appreciated as we work hard to expand this platform. You can also visit our page at buymeacoffee.com to contribute what you think the show is worth.
To the folks who are taking this step, we can't thank you enough. Look for the link in our show notes for more details about how you can support and follow us.
And now, please enjoy this episode. The reasons you either hate your job or love your job usually boil down to its culture, climate, or character. The reason you want to work for a company or a person usually comes down to their culture, climate, or character. With so many people right now feeling burned out and wanting to quit their jobs, with so many companies losing talent, with the great reshuffle, quote unquote, occurring, with pressure mounting on managers and the employees who are left behind with more workloads, and with the unprecedented amount of transformation that has taken place since the pandemic started, in which almost everyone's behavioral pattern changed, it's difficult to think of a more timely topic or a better person to join us than Dr. Kathy Hagler to talk about organizational change and organizational transformation. This is a lifelong passion and vision for you, Kathy. You are the founding partner of K2O Solutions and have been guiding organizations through complex changes for more than 40 years, really being a strong female pioneer in the field of organizational development after being mentored by and collaborating with two of the most important folks in the field, Dr. William Edwards Deming, known as the father of quality for his work in bringing change to business, and Dr. Peter Drucker, known as the father of modern management for his work on the principles of management. Your clients have included Big Brothers, Big Sisters, the Department of Defense, including the Air Force and Navy, the Department of Energy, the Department of Veterans Affairs, AT&T, Chevron, Pacific Gas and Electric, and Miami International Airport. You've even helped restaurant owners navigate cultural changes and unanticipated events such as COVID, and you have also helped universities such as Boise State, where you were part of the team that helped them transform into a research university and also helped them spin off the University of Western Idaho as a community college. The work you've done is remarkable. Jay and I both read your new book, Art of Scars, which is set to be published and available on September 28th, 2021. And both of us have been looking forward to this conversation because here's what makes you different. You pay special and close attention to the subconscious of a company and its employees. You know, the subconscious, where all our fear, our pain, and our wounds sit. And for anyone who's heard any of our podcasts, you know the subconscious is a topic Jay and I have covered many times before from different angles with different guests. But this is the first time we're going to be talking about it from this perspective, from the boardroom perspective. Dr. Kathy Hagler, welcome to the show, and thanks for taking some time out of your day with us. It really means a lot.
Thank you so much. I'm so delighted to be here. It's a big week for us. It's the week after September 11th. It's very important, and I believe that being here this week has special meaning for me. I'd like to start out by saying that my book is called The Art of Scars. The Art of Scars, I'd like to say, has two really big things you have to think about. Number one, it's an art object, so that at the end, you have a beautiful object of uniqueness and distinction. And that can either be you as a broken person or an organization as a broken and healed organization. But the other part about artistry is about the process. So art is really two things. Fine art is about how the product looks, but the other is all how do you put the product together. So what I'd like to talk about is the fact that I believe that we all have scars. And my book is about scars. And the way I approached my book is I started out by thinking, as a young child, I used to collect scars. I really didn't know that I was a collector of scars until I began to see that I was healing. So let me tell you about a couple of them. First, I had spinal meningitis as a baby. And then at 6 years old, I had cancer. My cancer left a really big scar on my arm. And I used to go to grade school and they would say, you've got a big funny thing on your arm. what is that, Kathy? And I would wear long sleeves and I would hide it until one day I figured out that scar is making me unique. Yeah. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to charge a quarter for them to see my scar. So that was my first entrepreneurial venture, because I used to charge a quarter for little kids to see my scar.
I love that. That's fantastic.
So I can say that I'm a very young entrepreneur.
Absolutely.
In looking at that, I began to see that scars began to happen to me throughout my life. My dad died when I was very young. I was 16. And I began to see that I could somehow move through that, and those scars made me more strong and more unique. Just like when I was selling the vision of my scar for 25 cents. Yeah. So I understood that scars were something really special. They were something really important for us to pay attention to. They began to give me wings. My comment and the way I feel about it now is scars give me wings. And what that means is taking flight frees yourself from the fear in your spirit. It frees yourself from your subconscious programs and your subconscious fears. It's almost like a state of grace. Mm-hmm. It lets us be who we were meant to be. But without those scars, we can't do that. Having those thoughts, I began to see that pain and in turn, the pain and in turn the growth that happened from scars really made us who we were. Our society doesn't often talk about this or emphasize this. In fact, to really understand more about the scars, I had to talk to my physician. And I said, so tell me about scars. You know, what are scars? And my physician said, well, the first thing you get with scars is you hurt like hell.
Yeah.
And so I thought, okay, that's true. When my dad died, when I got a scar on my arm, I hurt like hell. The second stage is called the proliferation stage, which means it begins to clean out and rebuild itself, and the tissues begin to come back together. And that takes some time. And in the meantime, and I didn't write too much about this in my book, but you're in what's called a liminal space. Mm-hmm. And in that liminal space, you're like, oh my goodness, I hurt like hell, but I'm feeling better. Where is this going? And finally, the scar begins to form. And once the scar begins to form, you get stronger and you begin to feel new again. Too many people, when they get scars, shove their head into a hole and they just sit there. They don't do anything about it. But what it is, it's a blessing in disguise. So what I'd like to talk about today is the art of scars as both individuals and organizations.
Love that. Actually, before we go on, one thing I wanted to say that around that and healing that I picked up from your book was, look, we all have the choice to heal or not. Whether we do it or not, doesn't matter. The clock is still going to be ticking. So, right. You know, it's on us to actually start healing after we feel that pain that you were talking about.
And what I love about this, and you're so right, Arjun, because I believe that the choice comes up from our free will. And so we have a subconscious, which are our thoughts and feelings. And then from that subconscious, based on almost the polyvagal theory, your subconscious then moves through your heart and you can feel it in your conscious. And your conscious, it's like what I called in the book, the footlights of consciousness. The lights come on and you say, I hurt like hell. You know, mm-hmm. What's going on here that I need to notice? And then once you notice it, it comes into your consciousness. And you can then make a choice.
Yeah. And you mentioned fine art a couple of beats back. I would love if you could share with our audience the Japanese fine art of kintsugi and how that relates as a metaphor to the idea of an individual or an organization healing their scars and coming back richer for having that experience.
I will, Jay, because that was really what turned me around to write the book. I knew that there was something that was related to my art of healing and my art of scars as a person, because I had a lot of them. But then I started to notice all these organizations that I've worked with for the last 40 years. They would hurt like hell, and then they would heal. I mean, then they would get this proliferation states, and then they would heal. And one day I saw a Kintsugi vase. And I remembered that Dr. Deming, who also worked in Japan, explained to me about the whole art of wabi-sabi. And the art of wabi-sabi is a lot of where he got a lot of his continuous improvement thinking and quality, which was nothing's perfect. Everything needs continuous improvement. Quality doesn't just happen. You have to work into continuous improvement. And so from traveling with him, what I learned in this art of wabi-sabi is that it's imperfect, but you don't have to leave it that way. You can take those imperfections and you can take those lessons and you can grow from it. So I went to see a Kintsugi artist. And you won't believe this, but here I live in Hendersonville, North Carolina, and I'm looking through the phone book. Okay, where would one find a Kintsugi artist? So I started in Asheville, North Carolina. Well, there weren't any there. And so you won't believe this, downtown on Main Street.
Stop. Wow. Crazy.
It's wild.
But it's the universe.
Wow.
It was time for me to find a Kintsugi artist. So bigger than Dallas, there was a sign that said Kintsugi artist and coach in Hendersonville, North Carolina. So I went to her and I said, you know, I really want to learn about Kintsugi. Well, Kintsugi are those vases, those beautiful vases that have been broken. All the pieces are laying on the ground, and Kintsugi artist is able to take those pieces and artistically form them back into the same vase, but not the same vase. Right. All of those broken places are filled in with gold. So when I saw that, I said, I want to learn how to do this. And so she taught me.
Nice.
Wonderful. Yeah. And one of the things I really liked in your description of learning how to engage in this art form of Kintsugi was the idea that, you know, after you break the vase, you're dealing with all these broken, fragmented pieces. Some are big, some are small. And you really, in order to get going, have to first start with like the biggest, most central pieces and build around that. And again, in terms of Kintsugi being such a great metaphor for dealing with our own pain, I think that metaphor holds in the idea of trying to focus on and prioritize the biggest and most central problems we have first and kind of build that as a foundation.
Jay, I think that's a really, really perfect analogy. I just remember that when she had me break the vase, the fear in my stomach. And you know, because you talk about this a lot on your podcast, fear in your subconscious is so prevalent. The fear when I saw all those pieces laying out there, and I thought, this will never happen. And then she said, you know, let's do this. And I said, well, then I'm going to watch you do it. And she said, no, you're going to do this. And then, of course, my fear went way up. And she said, let's start with the biggest piece. Well, I knew that. You know, we always know that. We know that let's find this piece, this large piece that's a prioritization of what's broken in us, and let's work on that piece. And that's what we do in organizations. Let's find that piece. Let's find that piece that are broken in the subconscious of the culture, of the subconscious of people and the culture. Let's work on that piece. Let's put that together first. And let's gently and gingerly bring together those other pieces and fill them in with gold. So it's the art of Kintsugi is not just the vase that stands up there in its glory with this gold wrapped around all of its breaks. But it, like you said, it's all the pieces as you go along. Find that larger piece. Because you know what? If you don't find that larger piece, the little pieces won't glue together appropriately. And guess what happens then? It has to break again. And you see and you refine the form. So organizations do the same. What is our issue? What is our big issue? What is our big thing that everybody agrees that we need to look at first? And then from that, let's come together. Let's join together collectively, as I call leaderful. Let's come together of that piece and let's put the vase back together with gold.
I love that. And it was striking to me to think about this because in your book, you, and just now in the conversation, you shared a couple of the tales of tragedy that you've been through. And then you paired it with this Japanese art that you just described. And really from that I think people can become more empathetic, because something that struck me while reading your book was, wow, it is really interesting to think about the people that I was riding elevators with, or the people I see on my Zoom screen. These are just broken individuals that are just trying to like figure out their own life, and they're hiding scars and they're putting a face on. And so like, let's help people feel more comfortable with their scars. Let's allow people to be more themselves while we're more of ourselves. And so I just found it really interesting to just think about like your team that you're working on. It's just a bunch of broken souls that are just trying to come together and make the best of what's going on here.
And I think the beauty of what you're saying is what I've learned from this is, and I teach yoga, but one of the things I really learned from this is the people in the elevator that you meet, the broken people in the elevator. If you think of that, 95% of what they do every day is their subconscious and its program. And so much of it is broken. And you know that they're dealing with that on an everyday level. And if what I've found is loving kindness to those people. Sometimes it just takes a smile in the elevator. Today I ran into a woman and I said, "It looks like you're writing a book." And she said, and she was in a restaurant, and she said, "Well, no, but I'm writing about my passion, which is I deal with people who've had abortions." And she talked to me for an hour.
Wow.
And I look at it like I'm just holding space. Yeah. And I listened to her because she had a lot of issues and she wanted to talk about those issues. And so I believe as human beings, if we can open the space just through kindness and through love, which is the language we need to speak, then people will open up and say, "Let me tell you what I'm working on." I mean, I didn't know for many, I just saw her sitting at a restaurant taking notes. Right. And that's how it happened. But I think that for me, it's really made me understand that not only organizations with all of those people coming together, but each person, like you said, in an elevator, they have all those things inside them, all these broken pieces. And if you're willing to hold that space, even in an elevator, to say, "Hi, you know, how are you doing?" Then they'll come around and they'll say, "Well, let me tell you about what I think about abortion."
Right. Yeah.
Well, I have to say, I mean, to that, it's like, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And it obviously occurred in your private one-on-one interaction there. But I mean, in a big corporation, like a lot of people are putting on a face, like they're at work, they're not going to want to talk about this stuff. So how really does a company, or how should leaders really start thinking about mining for the subconscious? Because that requires that every employee is able to come to the table with something that's honest, something that's truthful, and something that's not going to feel like they're being judged for saying. And so how do we actually break that?
You are so right. And, you know, I was so privileged to travel with Dr. Deming and be mentored by Dr. Drucker in my PhD. And they really looked at the climate of organizations, how things work. But they always said to me, it's really about the people. Mm-hmm. It's not just about the system. It's not just about the process. It's not just about our mission and vision and the way we train people. It's how do people feel, and how do people think, and how do people then react to those perspectives? And so I fortunately got very interested in culture about 20 years ago. And I got interested in it through one of my clients saying, "Help us find our values." And actually, this client was the Maricopa Community College District, which is the largest community college in Arizona. So I started looking at values, and we both said, the president was a really good friend of mine. And she said, "There's more to it than that. It's not just about values. It's about deep-seated beliefs. It's about something inside of us that everybody has that comes together as this culture." And with just the leader coming down and saying, "You should be trustworthy," that isn't going to do it.
Yeah.
And the time that I really noticed it wasn't going to do it is I was working with a construction company in LA, and I won't mention the name for reasons you'll soon understand. And so I said, let's look at what your, this is before I understood culture. I said, let's look at your values. I said, what's your main value? And one of the people on the team said, oh, our main value is honesty. We're really honest with the customer. And the CEO looked at me and he said, don't write that down. He said, we're not honest. He said, we don't tell the providers, we don't tell our suppliers, we don't tell the truth because we want to make more money. We can't go out and say to people we're honest when that's not the truth. And I thought of that and I thought, you know, what do people really think? What do people really believe is the truth about this culture? So I found a tool and it's through Human Synergistics International. And it's the one tool in the country, in the world, that basically measures beliefs. So when I go into a company, I say, let's measure beliefs of your people. That's how I start.
You know, I think as we move deeper into this topic, one thought I wanted to get out there was just the basic fact that psychology, be it either what's going on in people's subconscious or what's going on in people's belief systems, that's really what motivates human behavior. And that's what motivates action. And just like you see people's psychology inform their relationships and their behaviors with people in their private life, you know, be it their friends or their family, you know, their parents, their spouse, that same psychology motivates their behavior in the workspace. It's not like that social part of your human brain just turns off because you're in a work environment. I think a lot of times leadership will focus specifically on economic incentives. Like if we get the economic incentives right, then our employees will behave exactly as we want them to or expect them to. But it kind of goes back to the idea of, you know, behavioral economics. Like before the popularization of behavioral economics, there was belief among economists that every individual is sort of this autonomous decision maker that operates only with their best interest in mind, operates from a place of pure reason. And then the behavioral economics intellectuals came in and realized that, no, a lot of times people are imperfect. They're emotional. They make impulsive decisions. They don't behave perfectly rationally. And anyway, I think that same sort of concept holds true in the context of the work environment. Quite often, emotions play a huge role in the way people interact with each other, even if these emotions are counter to the incentives that leadership put in place. So again, just being conscious of the subconscious, of people's beliefs, of the core values, of what impression they're getting from their organization about what that culture is, how they're being treated by their coworkers, that can matter a heck of a lot more in steering people's behavior than just economic incentives alone.
It can. And I want to tell you, give you some science behind this, because what I think that's important for businesses, and particularly because I work with a lot of scientists, I work with a lot of engineers, a lot of scientists, they have to understand there's a science behind this.
Yeah.
You know, because you can't just say this will make you feel better.
Mm-hmm.
Because they don't like that word. Feeling is not a good word for them. Thinking and solving is a good word, but not proving, but not feeling. So let's give them some science. So in the Biology of Belief by Bruce Lipton, he brings out the fact that let's talk first about cells. So the biology of belief is the fact that each of our cells are like a tiny little human being. Each cell is like a little human being, and each of those cells have a brain. That brain is the nucleus, just like we have a brain. And then those cells are programmed. They're programmed through the external environments, and they're programmed, and their survival depends on their ability to adjust to change. That happens inside our environment. And guess how they survive? And I love this. I just went to work with Bruce Lipton in Taos last week. The cells don't struggle for survival. They snuggle for survival.
Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah. Expand on that.
Yeah. They come together as groups. And what they do is as they come together as groups to protect each themselves, then what they do is they grow together as a clump, and they grow together to make you stronger. It's a group of cells. So it's like people. So if you think about it, people have brains, just like a cell does. And so we have our nucleus and we have our subconscious and our conscious. Our subconscious is 95% of what's been programmed for the first 7 years of our life. So I don't think about it when I brush my teeth. I don't think, go get the toothbrush, get out the toothpaste. I mean, I don't think about it when I drive the car. So that our brains are 95% programmed, just like a computer. We're software. And our conscious is like the hardware. So we're like cells. So what we find is when our subconscious program is making us fearful and afraid of survival, just like a cell. When our subconscious is afraid, if we then raise it up to the conscious level and come together with other people, don't struggle for survival, snuggle.
I like that.
It's the same with organizations. So cells are made up with individual brains. People are made up with brains. And the organization then is having the climate, which is the way work is done. And then it's the culture. And they are snuggled together. They can either work together or they cannot work together. So what you have to find out, and I'll go back to what you just asked me a few minutes ago, what's their largest piece that's broken?
It's probably the people, right?
Yeah. So see the analogy?
Yeah, absolutely. Seeing the organization as just a collection of people is a perfect, you know, just the way that cells gather together, it's a perfect metaphor. And when people are not snuggling together in times of hardship for the company, when they're actually struggling against each other, then, you know, maybe an organization is on the verge of breaking down.
And guess what they see it? Guess where they see it? They see it in the bottom line, the thing they're worried about. But it's hard for them to think about that because they want to focus on that rather than focus on the 95% that's making a difference.
So yeah. Let's talk about that 95% and how you're able to bring what's going on in an organization's subconscious up into the conscious so it can be dealt with.
Okay, what is important for me to know, what's important for me to know when I start out in an organization is what's the health of their culture? And you can't learn about the health of their culture unless you have a leaderful team at the top. Because if I were to go into a company today and say, I want to do a health check on your culture, I would probably be riding a plane home. Yeah. Because people are afraid of that. They don't know what culture is.
Exactly.
And it's just how you and me feel and we believe. It's not scary. But what I want to do is I want to look at what are the huge pieces of scars that you have in your culture? What are the broken? What's that piece? What are those big pieces I have to put back in the vase? So what I do is I show the leader this Kintsugi vase. And I say, have you ever been broken? Well, yeah, we've been broken a lot. Well, think about this. What do you think about this vase? Well, it's really beautiful. Well, guess how much it sells for? Well, a whole lot more than it did before I got it, you know, at Humane Society for $3.
Right. Yeah.
So what we're saying is that the scars can give you wings. The scars can give you opportunities to evolve. So let's look first at the health of your culture. So I start out by then asking them if we can do a check on the health of their culture. And through that culture inventory, which is very quick, it takes 20 minutes. But this it's amazing tool. And the company that I've worked with, you do this inventory, then you go back to the leaderful team and you say, you know, these many of you people are very passive. This many of your people are very aggressive. And this many of your people are actually very humanistic and trying to succeed. So what you try to do is you try to figure out where is the defensiveness happen and where is the humanistic encouraging happen? And how do we find this huge piece that's broken?
Interesting. Yeah. So that's really interesting because, I mean, from your book, just thinking about it, you're talking about how culture drives climate. Climate represents the organization's consciousness. And here we are trying to like measure and define or maybe improve something that's so elusive as company culture. But then when you think about it in the context of, hey, everyone is just broken, a broken vase right now, and we're just trying to put it all together, then you realize like the reason you're hearing things from your boss is because they're hearing things from their boss, and everyone is just kind of masking their fears and taking it out in either a defensive way, or you can like kind of feel the tone. It's a passive aggressive tone that you might feel from your manager, but that's because they're feeling some pressure from their manager because everyone's masking their wounds right now and scars because no one's actually able to completely authentically really talk about it and or have like clarity on it.
They don't know how. We've not been taught how to deal with those feelings of fight, flight, and freeze.
Especially at work with coworkers. Yeah.
With coworkers, because people think if they're passive, they think, oh, what are they going to think of me? Am I going to look bad? I'm going to go avoid that meeting. I'm going to go over here and sit down, or maybe I'm just not going to talk. But heaven forbid that I should open my mouth and look stupid. Or then there's the other person who's aggressive defensive, who says, it's going to be my way. It's not going to be any other way, because that's the way they feel. That's the way they've been programmed. Mm-hmm. See, we've all been programmed differently. Mm-hmm. I mean, you two are probably very differently programmed. I have my program. I know what I do because I've been through this process. And I know that I tend to, when I get scared, I go hide in the weeds.
Yeah.
It makes me nervous. I don't get competitive. I don't get, you know, I'm a flyer. I fly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so you're not going to put yourself out there, right?
No.
Like, you're fearful.
Oh. No, but I have a friend that's very aggressive. So when I run away from her, she chases me down. So I think it's also a really good thing in marriages, if you think about it, you know. How are you, passive? Are you defensive? And what are those behaviors that, if you could change them, would make all the difference in the world about how you feel about each other and how the relationship is? Because if you don't struggle, you what? Snuggle.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting. When you think about the three natural reactions to fear, fight, flight, or freeze, none of them sound particularly constructive on the face. How do you think about responding to fear in a constructive way? There's going to be incidents that lead to employees or leadership feeling fearful. There will always be events that produce fear in people, I think, in life and in corporate work. But what is the ideal place you can get to in the sense of like, how are people responding to fear? How are they programming themselves to respond to fear when it boils up inside themselves?
I think I put together a model called SCARS in my book. And I've been using that myself a lot because it came from my learning how to put together a Kintsugi vase. I wrote it down as I was doing it. S stands for you have to stop that feeling. You have to stop the broken feeling. So if I'm feeling afraid, let's say yesterday I was on an interview and one of the questions the guy asked me scared me. I mean, I'll tell you what it was. He said, how do you feel about the vaccine? And I'm thinking, I don't know if I want to talk about that right now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, but I had to stop the broken thought and feeling. And then the second thing is I had to courageously calm the fear. Mm. That's C. So what it is once I noticed the fear, once I named it, it's a fear about somebody thinking bad of me one way or the other. And they're going to one way or the other. They're not going to like it.
Right, exactly. Know?
If I say I have no thoughts about it, they'll think I'm a numbskull, you know? So, I mean, you've got to have an opinion.
Yeah, right.
So I courageously calmed the fear. I took a deep breath and I said, okay, I'm going to allow for connectivity with others. So I said to him, how do you feel about it?
Love that. Put it right back on their table.
And he said, well, this is the way I feel about it. And at the time when I could do that, I was snuggling. At the time when I could do that, I then said, here's how I feel about it. Mm-hmm. And my fear was gone. And he said, how can we use that? You know, how can we use our ideas about the vaccine? So we started talking about it and I wasn't scared anymore. So it's a matter of finding, how do you stop the feeling right when you feel it? And you know what fear feels like. I mean, you can feel it almost in every body place in your body, sometimes in your hands. I mean, it's scary. And once you feel the fear, notice it and then calm it. Take a deep breath. Think about naming that fear. Okay, my fear is about this. I don't want to look bad. Mm-hmm. You know, And so then allow connectivity. So what do you think about it? And he said, well, here's what I think about it. And I said, so let me tell you what I think about it. And how do we come together on that? So it's what you have to do is you have to just stop the feeling, become courageously calm about your fear. And I would say that works in both flight and fight. I'm not sure it works in freeze. Because freeze, I mean, I think there's a point that people should be afraid. I mean, I think you read in my book when a man broke into my hotel room and I had held a gun in my head.
That was crazy.
What a wild story.
Well, I froze. I mean, it's not like I can say, okay, let me think about this call.
This
thing on my head. That's called freeze. In fact, when I wrote the book, I thought, okay, how am I going to talk about freeze? Oh, yeah, I'm going to talk about freeze. Fortunately, for people who haven't read the book, I got away. But I mean, freeze, you don't move at all. Everything in your body, there's no movement. Your legs don't move. Your heart doesn't move. You just stop. And I think fear is built into us from the very, very our early ancestors when the tigers came after them. You know, we either learn to fight, flight, or, okay, this tiger, I just need to stand here because I don't have any place to go. So they're all built into us for a reason. We have to look at the reason, calm the fear, and then figure out how we're going to deal with it. And most of the time, I think it's allowing some connectivity with something else that's living. And by the way, sometimes I think it's not something that's living like a person. It might be a dog. It might be a tree. You know, I believe there's energy in the universe that gives us peace. And so if we can connect with the universe and nature, sometimes it doesn't need to be a person.
True.
You know, Fido works just fine.
Yeah. But I think a key word there is connection, though. Connection matters so much. And obviously in that context, it matters, but it also matters in another context, which you laid out in the book, which is around this idea of connection magic. I think that's something that we can talk about a little bit. Because I actually was thinking about it when I was reading your book about my own experience of this concept while working on a sales team. But maybe you want to talk a little bit about it and then I can share a story around that.
Okay.
Connection magic.
Connection magic is when people begin to see other people's scars and they begin to know, oh, they're broken too. And look at this. We have the same big piece that's broken. For instance, there was a piece that we noticed at a school, a university I was working at on the East Coast. There were a whole lot of students, and you know what they were afraid of? Cheating. And that was in my book. It was connection magic. Once they saw and once they talked about the fact that we're not going to be good engineers because we're cheating our way through school.
It's crazy.
It's crazy. So the connection magic brings voice. And that's what I love about this is connection magic brings voice to the subject. And tell me your story.
Yeah. So it's a little bit different because you're mentioning, you know, people see other people's scars. The way I was reflecting on it was actually it's a way for an employee to see a company's scars. And so if you think about it from just like, let's put ourselves as a leader, you know, something I really changed in my previous life. You know, I worked at a big corporation for almost 10 years. And for the first five, I felt like we were always told to work on this campaign, like go sell this fund or, you know, go save these assets. And there was no real why. And then I remember one day somebody came in, it was a new leader, and they finally started to talk about like, okay, if you are able to go save this many assets, it helps our bottom line by this much. And that was the first time that the messaging like that was being shared with a sales team. And so all of a sudden there was a connection magic. It's like, oh my God, if I actually do this campaign, if I save these assets, if I don't have anyone else sell out of this product, oh, I'm going to help my company bottom line by this much. And ultimately, let's face it, that helps my bonus pool. So I was just thinking about it like that. It's like, that was a huge shift for the entire sales team. And from that meeting for like the last 5 years of my tenure there, every type of campaign came along with a message of like, okay, if you do it by this much, we'll be able to save this percentage, or we'll be able to bring in this amount of revenue. So my whole point of sharing that story is if anyone's out there as a leader or anyone is out there feeling like they're just on the totem pole, like there's an ability for you to actually try to step into a leadership perspective and like think about it from like what your leaders are thinking about. And if you're a leader and you want your sales team to start acting and connecting and actually, you know, moving in one way, maybe your messaging is missing that one component, which is like, okay, like here's the impact on our bottom line. I know it sounds so basic, but the fact is that for half of my career, I didn't hear it. And then the second half of my career, that's all I heard. So it was a huge shift.
So you need to tell them why.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
You know, and I love that. I love the golden circle that comes from Simon Sinek. You know, first thing you do is tell people why. Because if the CEO and the leaderful team doesn't tell people the vision and why we're doing this, it's hard for people to get connected in the organization. So they know why. We're trying to be here. We're trying to be this. It's like when I talked about Boise State University, they wanted to be a metropolitan research university of distinction. Well, number one, they weren't metropolitan and they weren't a research university and they weren't distinct. But guess what? They are now.
Yeah.
And I think though, so what you have to do is you say, just like what you said, why am I doing this? Where am I going? So that's the reciprocity. Thank you for pointing that out. But that's the reciprocity, is tell them why, help them figure out what's my role in the why.
Right.
And see, that's what you did in your job. You said, here's my role in the why. I can do these four things. And the beauty of what I'm talking about in a culture, if you find the big piece, you can all do why together.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Mm-hmm. You know, let's move this big thing. Let's move this big piece together and we can make a big difference. And one of the things, for instance, that Boise State did is they said, you know, we have all these freshmen and sophomores, but we don't have any money to get into research because we're funding all of the undergraduate work. And why were they doing it? It was because there was no community college. So they said, let's spin off a community, let's get the community to fund. And that took a 2/3 majority vote by the Senate. Let's get them to fund a community college. Let them do that. And let's do research. So they failed this huge chunk, this big piece of things that they really needed to take, put off to the side, their why. And then people could begin to say, okay, now we can get money for research facilities. Now we can get a new engineering building. Now we can get a new science building. But they couldn't before that because guess what? They didn't know why.
Yeah. I think kind of part and parcel of that is the idea of an organization forming their core values and being specific about their core values. You bring up the example of Zappos in your book. Their core values are be adventurous, creative, and open-minded. And they work really hard to, as you say, construct an environment where their employees can actually live up to that goal. I think it's really important to have a certain level of like specificity and uniqueness to your core values and to your why, because I think if it's too generic, if it's too similar to the person or the business next door, it's hard for people to really latch onto that. So I really appreciated you including that in your book because it made me think differently. You know, if I'm ever at some point in the future tasked with helping an organization carve out their core values, that level of specificity is really important.
That's very important. And if you look at Zappos with adventuresome, being adventuresome, I mean, look how that fits their personality.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, and I think that's really important. And then with the culture survey, what you could find out are what are people's strengths, you know, and what we found out at Boise State, their strength was research.
Mm-hmm.
So that becomes one of their values. And then you can say, let's all get behind that, but it's a specific thing. Let's don't just teach. Let's right. teach for a reason, just like Zappos did. So that's very important. The vision is very critical. What you do, the mission and how you, what? So the vision is where you're headed. I'm going over there. The mm-hmm. vision, the mission is this is the work I do. This is my purpose. And the values is this is how we behave to each other. And if everybody can develop that together after they do the survey and they understand their culture and say, here's what we love to do. And this is our mission. Then they can get behind it. The why becomes beautiful. That's the reciprocity.
Mm-hmm.
Jay, I love that you brought that up just a moment ago, because also reading the book, Big Brothers, Big Sisters was an organization that, you know, Kathy, you were working with. I found it really interesting that they had a messaging issue within their own community. Like, people literally needed to know the difference between what they were doing and what the next agency serving youths were doing. Like, imagine that. I mean, it was kind of shocking for me to like read that. And then that's when I realized, like, oh my God, this is exactly why being different is better than being better. Because when you're different, you stand out. And you know, this is, you have to build something that's different. So Jay, to your point, I think being different, being specific is just so key. But Kathy, I have a question for you. I mean, you know, in your mind, what is something right now organizations could be working on, or what type of investments can they be making to ensure their success for the future? And how would an organization know that it's time to revisit their mission versus revisit their vision?
Let me answer your second question first. I love the example in Built to Last and Good to Great when he talks about the fact that Motorola was around 100 years, and so was but then Motorola started when Packard Bell did, and Packard Bell died and Motorola didn't. So what was the difference? Well, Motorola's vision was to make the very best vacuum tubes. Their mission was to have the very best communication. Motorola understood that they had to change their vision. You can't stay with vacuum tubes. So what happens is about every 3 years, and now I would say about every year, the way we're going with technology, you need to say, is this our right vision? Because you don't make vacuum tubes anymore. Yeah. So what happens if people have a vision that they're saying, this is our vision for the next 20 years? Well, they probably won't make it for the next year.
So but you're saying keep the mission
keep the
tight,
mission
and then the vision the, shifty.
Yes. Keep the mission who you are. You know, we mentor kids. Now, how you're going to mentor kids with their vision. I mean, we had to switch three times last year with Big Brothers, Big Sisters, because you know why? We couldn't meet with mentoring one-on-one.
Right.
We had to learn to do it in a new way. So our vision was, you know, we create these bonds, not one-on-one, but we create these bonds however we need to create these bonds.
Yeah.
And guess what else they had to do? They had to add the families, because the kids and the families were really struggling. So the vision changes with the environment. And you have to be careful that you don't let it go so long that what happens is that it no longer has any meaning, like vacuum tubes.
Yeah, right.
Yeah,
that makes sense. Yeah, it kind of reminds me of that quote you had in the book. I really love this quote. I'd never heard it before, from Peter Drucker. Strategy is a commodity. Execution is an art. Just the idea of having an adaptable strategy, but always being able to adapt the execution along with that. That's kind of the hard part.
Yes, it is. And I think that's the art of the scar. Is how do you look at that? You know, this is our scar, but what is our vision? Well, our vision maybe let's make sure we've got the right vision, because as you do that, you need to make sure you're heading in the right direction to really become unique. And that's been really important for Big Brothers, Big Sisters, because nobody knew who they were. And so we had a lot of problems to solve, a lot of scars.
Yeah. Now there's a list of questions I wanted to read from your book, if you don't mind. I think it's a great way to summarize a lot of what we just talked about. And for anyone right now who's listening, you know, they're a leader, they're a builder, they're anywhere on the totem pole. I mean, just thinking about a mission, a couple questions that are worth sharing. Why does the organization exist? What is our business? Whom does the organization serve? What are the current customer segments? Who are future customers or clients? What value would customers or clients find in our service or product? What is the specific value we need to bring to our customers and clients? It's a nice little checklist of questions to kind of recalibrate, but I do want to add a few to that that I was thinking about. You know, when your business is moving smoothly and in the right direction, what is that like? What are some examples of when your business started moving in the opposite direction and what did you do about it? And then I actually wanted to ask you something about, you know, just taking your entire experience and all the people you've worked with, what are your thoughts on referability? You didn't really talk about it in your book, so this is something that's new for the conversation, but I would love to hear your thoughts on referability in the context of this conversation, because there's so many people out there that rely on referrals to grow their business, and they'll claim that they get a ton of referrals. But I really wonder how many people even know if they're a referable company.
I think how I would deal with that question, I think it's a wonderful question, because I've never marketed ever.
See?
But what I did was I constantly quizzed my customers, and I constantly understood what they wanted and what they didn't want. And so I was constantly looking at the value proposition that they needed from me. Mm-hmm. And so the value proposition, meaning, why do I want you? You know, what is it that I need you for that I can't do myself? And so I constantly looked at that. I constantly talked to them, and I constantly learned. I take at least 5 new classes a year, and I have for 40 years, because the customers change. A couple of years ago, I couldn't get into one of the classes in the U.S. on organizational mapping and processes. So I went to Berlin. I said, well, that's the only place I can get it. So I'm going to Berlin. Yeah. But, you know, that's what the customer wanted. And you know what they were looking for is, how do we get the supply chain right? So I needed to understand that. And I couldn't find a place around here where I could understand it. So the referability is, if you really understand your current customers, what they like about you and what they don't, and you're keeping within that. Yeah. Remember, change the vision. Right. If you're changing that movement, if you're going down that path, then you know. If they start saying, for instance, I'll give you an idea. One of my clients recently asked me to redo their facility. Well, I took it on because they'd been a 30-year client. I did a terrible job. And basically the client says, you know, this isn't your thing. You know, you're not one to design my office space. I really tried, but you know what? That wasn't my thing. So I know I won't get referred for that. So yeah, I'm not going to be advertising that I can redesign your office space.
Mm. Yeah.
You need to understand your strengths and your value.
Yeah. I love that. And then there's an element of not having the fear of asking long established clients questions, and like kind of training them with some of the language that they might be able to use with their network. Right. So I was just kind of thinking about this a little bit, and it's like, if I actually had a practice for 40 years doing anything, law, dental, I was a financial advisor, I was you, whatever, right? It's like, as long-term clients, what do you view as the most valuable thing we offer? When you had multiple options, why did you choose us? And how would you, as a client, explain what makes us different? I thought those were like 3 questions that you can easily ask an established client and get them to start talking, and then use their answers and just let them know, like, hey, that's all you have to say to your friends.
I would add one.
Yeah, sure.
And I just got off the phone to somebody right before I talked to you, who's a client that retired at 55. I've worked with this person in 3 different organizations. He was the CEO, and he called and said, can I be a consultant with you? Can I come to work for you? He said, I want to do what you do. I want to help people. Now, if they don't ever ask you, or if you ask them if they want to work for you and you say, not in a million years, then you probably know there's something wrong there.
Yeah. Right.
You guys are so great to talk to. I wish we could just talk all day. You're really
great. Appreciate
thank you
your
for
time.
Thank you for the questions.
No, absolutely. There's a lot in your exactly. There's a lot in your book we didn't even cover that people need to read about. Things like entropy, connective leadership. There's a bunch of checklists in your book that are worth reading through. We talked about leaderful organizations. Since we are wrapping up here, we will ask you one final question, which is, based on your book, we know one of your favorite songs is The River by Garth Brooks and Victoria Shaw. But what's the last song you actually sung along to?
I've Got Friends in Low Places, Garth Brooks.
Nice, nice.
I'm a country girl. I come from New Mexico.
Oh, love it.
And I was just driving down the street and he was singing, I've Got Friends in Low Places.
Oh, it's classic.
I've been to see him 3 times. I love his music.
Oh, that's
awesome.
We love that.
Dr. Hagler, thank you again for allowing us to chat side by side with you. You're great. You're successful. You're the type of people that we want to be around. And in the context of the environment that we're in, where things are becoming more disruptive, more turbulent, more competitive. A lot of what we touched on today and what you dive deeper in the book, these are the types of layers that we need to start thinking through, because again, this is through the leadership lens. So thank you for opening our world.
Thank you.
And you know, appreciate the contributions that you had for us, not only through the book, but over 40 years of helping so many people.
Arjun and Jay, thank you very much. This has been great. Thank you.
If you enjoyed this episode, you can sign up for the Rising Weekly newsletter sent out each week.
Every Friday, we expand on the episode with insights, recommendations, and more.
You can sign up at risinglaterally.com.
Thank you.